KaiserNetwork.org.
Today's briefing is being co-sponsored by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, and we want to thank CSIS and in particular Steve Morrison for co-sponsoring this event with us. Our goal in convening today's briefing was to allow both for reflection on the conference among those who attended, such as us here and many of you in the audience, and those who didn't, and also, probably more importantly, to provide an opportunity to look forward, a critical look forward. Where did the conference leave us off? Where do we need to go from here? How can we seize upon the energy and momentum that inevitably results when more than 26,000 passionate people come together to focus on the same global problem, to tackle the HIV/AIDS epidemic? And how to make this conference be more than its literal time period in Toronto last month? To borrow from the powerful words of Dr. Helene Gayle, who spoke these words at the opening session of the Toronto conference, these conferences can no longer be thought about as isolated single events, but should instead be seen as part of a process that helps us mark our progress and give us an opportunity to show ourselves and the world that we can make tangible progress towards ending this epidemic. The 40 million people living with HIV/AIDS, their families, and their communities deserve nothing less. Thanks, Helene, for letting me borrow your words. At the same time, it's sobering in some way to think that this was the 16th International AIDS Conference, conferences which began in Atlanta in 1985. And probably between those of us on this panel and all of you here, we have people who've been to every single one of those conferences. And we also know many people who did not live to go to these conferences, and we did not expect to be in this place. Having said that, I do think this conference was different and more visible, marking an important moment in good and challenging ways. For example, the elevation of prevention onto the agenda in a new way that I think we'll hear about today. The discussion around science on prevention tools and other areas. The increased focus on women and gender. Lots of discussion about accountability and many other areas. And some things that we might not hear about today but were important nonetheless, such as the fact that the Global Village, which is an important part, physical space at the conference, was right there in the middle of the conference this time. Things like that that I think gave it a different feeling than prior conferences. So to consider these questions and help make this conference and others more than single isolated events, we have asked the following distinguished guests, and as well as you, the distinguished audience, to participate in today's conversation. And I want to thank our panelists, Steve Morrison and Todd Summers, and in particular, Dr. Helene Gayle, for making themselves available and allowing themselves to be on the spot for providing their thoughts on the conference. I also want to just note that, unfortunately, Dr. Phil Nyberg could not be with us today due to a family emergency. I'm going to briefly let you know a little bit about our panelists, although you have bios, and I'm sure you know them all. But I'd like to just be able to say a few things about them. And Dr. Helene Gayle just finished her service as the president of the International AIDS Society and co-chair of AIDS 2006. And she is currently the president and CEO of CARE USA. And as you know, has worked tirelessly on addressing this epidemic and global health challenges for many years, most recently at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and before that for the U.S. federal government at CDC, USAID, and has played numerous other roles in really making a difference in our nation's and world's response to HIV. And as one of the main architects of AIDS 2006, someone who set out to ensure that this conference made its mark, we will hear from Helene about how she thinks it went and, perhaps more importantly, what comes next. Todd Summers is Senior Policy Officer for Global Health at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where he plays a major role in supporting the Global Fund and supporting global health advocacy efforts. And many of you know Todd as well from his years of working on HIV/AIDS issues at the White House and with numerous other organizations. Todd will speak to the role of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, particularly its principals, Bill Gates and Melinda Gates, who were very visible at this conference and played critical roles there, as well as what they began talking about, their agenda for the next few years. And then we'll hear from Steve Morrison, who is the executive director of the CSIS HIV/AIDS Task Force and the director of the CSIS Africa Program. Steve has long worked on issues pertaining to Africa and foreign policy initiatives generally for the U.S. government before coming to CSIS and at CSIS Among other things, he conceived of and launched the Task Force on HIV/AIDS in 2001, which is co-chaired by Senators Frist and Feingold. And for those of us working in D.C., we know the important role that this task force has played in helping to inform the U.S. role in addressing the global epidemic. And that's exactly what Steve will speak to today, the connection between the conference and issues raised there and implications for the U.S. government role. Before we turn to our speakers, I first want to help bring the conference into this room a little bit more in a more tangible way. And I'm therefore pleased to be able to show you some video snapshots from the conference that were culled together from the Kaiser Network webcast. Kaiser Network was the official webcaster of the conference, and we were fortunate to be able to put this together for today. We're also webcasting this event today. Before we show the clips, I just want to note that these are not necessarily meant to be inclusive, but rather capture some of the moments and sentiments of the conference. And I really do encourage you to go online and look at the many webcasts that are there, the transcripts that are there, and in many cases, speaker presentations. And after the video, I'll turn to each speaker who will briefly present, and then we'll engage in a discussion with everyone here. Thanks.
The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Today, 25 years into this epidemic, we have a real opportunity to deliver like never before. We have more resources, more knowledge, more political commitments than ever before. But still, the epidemic continues to outpace us. So it is time for us to assure that promises made are promises kept. We must demand action over rhetoric and evidence over ideology. It is time to deliver.
No matter where she lives, who she is, or what she does, a woman should never need her partner's permission to save her own life.
I think you need far more people talking out about actively saying, I am HIV positive in my country, I'm living, I'm healthy, I'm on antiretrovirals. And I think as we get more of those examples, we're going to start to break through stigma. I think we're just starting to see it now because it hasn't been that long that you could get ARVs.
I just don't believe we can reverse this if we keep having more people infected every year than we are increasing the number of people on medication. And if we keep having 90% of the people not knowing their status, I don't see how we can do that. Just as no government organization can win the fight against AIDS alone, prevention, care, and treatment are intertwined. And we cannot realize universal treatment, I'll say again, let alone stop AIDS, unless we also see prevention as a part of a mutually dependent strategy.
This epidemic is evolving in the midst of a chronic crisis of child health and poverty in sub-Saharan Africa. And the problems of poverty aggravate the HIV epidemic, and the HIV epidemic in turn aggravates the poverty that is being experienced.
Your kids, we're the future. We really are. And if we're not educated, I don't think we're going to have a bright future.
We've reached a point in the AIDS epidemic globally where we have many resources, many technologies that are available both for prevention and for treatment, which give us the capability to save hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of lives, both in terms of people already infected and people and preventing new HIV infections. But what that does is it puts an even greater onus on governments to provide the political leadership to make sure that health systems and governance gets those technologies and implements them in a way that is effective in curtailing and mitigating the AIDS epidemic.
In my view, as delegates doubtless know, the most vexing and intolerable dimension of the pandemic is what is happening to women. It's the one area of HIV and AIDS which leaves me feeling most helpless and most enraged. Gender inequality is driving the pandemic, and we will never subdue the gruesome force of AIDS until the rights of women become paramount in the struggle. I challenge you, my fellow delegates, to enter the fray against gender inequality. There is no more honorable and productive calling. There is nothing of greater import in this world. All roads lead from women to social change, and that includes subduing the pandemic. For my own part, when I leave the post of envoy at the end of the year, I have asked that my successor be an African, but most important, an African woman. Thank you.
More than ever, we confirmed during this week that prevention and care are two faces of the same coin. More than ever, biomedical and behavioral scientists have the challenge and the opportunity to work together with people living with HIV and community organizations towards our common goals. Of course, all the knowledge, the innovative research, the new tools will not be effective without the political leadership that is essential to halting this disease.
We will talk at AIDS 2008 about human beings, each of whose life, as Melinda Gates reminded us at the opening ceremony, are of equal value, whether you are gay or straight, sex trade worker or a stay-at-home mom, black or white, mestizo or native, rich or poor, young or not so young.
It's actually quite overwhelming looking at that and kind of reliving a lot of memories from the conference. As Jen said, I was the conference co-chair for 2 years, and so put a lot of my life, energy, and time over the last 2 years into trying to make this a successful conference, along with the International AIDS Society and the other co-chairs that are responsible for planning this conference. And so stepping back and having a chance to think about it, having kind of taken the last 3 weeks to totally forget it, is quite an interesting opportunity. And so I'm glad that we're here, and I hope, as Jen said, we really do have a chance to think about not only the conference and what it taught us, but where do we go from here? Because as she said, in borrowing my words, we really did for this conference want this to start being, not that none of them ever were in the past, but really more deliberately seeing this as part of a process, and really not seeing these conferences as points in time, but really things that can continue the momentum for our community overall. So, I hope we have a chance to think about that. When you go into these planning these conferences, you start thinking about what theme do you want to get across? What's occurred over the last, since the last conference, that we think really capsulizes in a thematic sort of way where we want to go with the efforts in HIV/AIDS and the community. And there is no perfect topic, and we went through lots of debates about what should the theme be, and you never. There are never any single words that can encapsulate it, but we thought that the theme of time to deliver was a very timely theme in many ways. We're 25 years into this epidemic. The last time we met in North America and Canada 10 years ago for the Vancouver conference was when HART first broke on the scene, and the hopefulness of treatment and the One World, One Hope theme came out very strongly, and really this focus on how do we deliver treatment and how do we close the gap between rich and poor. And I think we looked at where we were and thought that at this point in time, 25 years into this epidemic, we really do have more of what it takes to make a difference in this epidemic, but we really weren't giving it our all in certain ways. And the idea that we now, we don't have the $22 billion that it's projected we'll need in 2007, but we have $8.5 billion, which, if we compare that to a decade ago, is light years ahead. We do know a lot more. We have political leadership like we never have, with the different commitments that have been made with the G8 and UN General Assembly, et cetera. So we had the political commitment. We had the knowledge. We have the financial resources. And yet and still, we're not really moving forward
as if we believed that we could. And so the theme of Time to Deliver was really one where we say, let's hold ourselves accountable like we never have before, so that when we come back together in 2 years, we actually can talk about the progress that's made. And I think, you know, again, while it's hard to say that any few words actually pulls all that together, I think that there was a sense of, yes, let's put our resolve together and make a difference and be accountable. And I think that that did come through throughout the tone of the conference. So that was the theme. And the conferences, as people, and there are many people in this room who have been part of these conferences for years, you know, it does at least three things. It tries to pull together the best information and allow for people to come together and share information. So scientists talk to scientists, policymakers talk to policymakers, program people talk to program people, and it's the opportunity to talk across those different groups so that everybody comes away feeling like you've made the kind of connections, you've learned the kind of information that will help you do your job better when you go back. Secondly, it is a conference that brings together a diverse range of communities. You have everyone from the most basic scientists to your community grassroots activists, and that's unique in this conference. There are very few, possibly this may be unique in the world in terms of a conference focused on a particular issue that really brings these communities together in ways that I think is pretty remarkable. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. And then the third is really renewing commitment. I think we all come away from there not only having learned, shared information, learned more, brought different communities together, but I think we all come out of that meeting feeling more committed and more passionate about the work we do. So I think those three things are key to this conference and perhaps make it unique. And I feel in many ways we were able to meet those different challenges. And I'll be interested to see what others feel about that. As Jen said, I think this conference in many ways, each conference at the end of it, you kind of say, well, gee whiz, here's a theme that popped out like never before. And I think for many reasons, this conference is the conference that put prevention on the map like never before. It didn't hurt that Bill and Melinda Gates were the keynotes and that they really stress prevention. Stopping HIV is the key priority of the Gates Foundation, which Todd will talk about more. But clearly, throughout their talks, the issue of prevention came across loud and clear. For the first time, Bill Clinton, I think, became a prevention champion like never before. Not that he didn't understand that prevention was important, but Clinton himself admits that he went into this because he saw people dying, saw the imperative to treat people who were dying and getting medication to them. But as a result of that, and as his clip said, you do the math. You can't keep up with treatment if you don't really focus on prevention. And ultimately, that's our goal. Why not stop people from getting the infection to begin with, recognizing that we have a moral and human obligation to get treatment to those already infected? So I think time after time, person after person, this was the first conference when treatment people who spend their life on treatment, like a Julio Montana, who gave a really lovely keynote presentation that basically said, we've got to start thinking about our treatment as how it actually reinforces our prevention efforts. And that's the first time that twist, where in the past we've talked about how prevention can support treatment, this is the first time where we've really had that shift where people looking at treatment really think about how it supports prevention. Came across as a high priority. The prevention working group that Jen and I co-chair and the Gates Foundation, along with Kaiser, co-funds, co-convenes, I guess we are. Came out with a really important report this year that I don't know if everybody has that, looking at new prevention research, which was a theme of Bill Gates' presentation, really how do we get new tools, particularly tools that focus on the needs of women. So I think that came through loud and clear. As a result of that, or in keeping with that, I think the issues of women came out much stronger in this meeting than ever before. And as you saw from all the clips, everybody spoke about the fact that we are woefully negligent in our ability to provide options to women that meet the needs of their lives, and that we've got to do a better job of facing the challenges that women face if we're going to do a greater a better job in prevention. And I think that that broke down then into two different categories. One, how do we get better prevention tools, which was the key focus of both Bill and Melinda's talk. But then the other side, which is how do we look at some of the broader underlying vulnerabilities that that put women at risk to begin with. And I think that that's going to be a theme that continues as we talk about how do we have an impact on this epidemic. We can't do it if we don't look at some of the underlying issues. We can't do it if we don't look at gender inequality that Stephen Lewis talked about, if we don't look at the realities of poverty and what places people at risk because of lack of economic livelihood, particularly women who end up being vulnerable because of lack of economic options, if we don't look at issues like food security that are putting people at risk, both those who are already infected as well as people, again, women who oftentimes have to sell bodies in order to get put food on their table. So I think there's a whole range of issues that start popping out as we look at where are we missing the boat in terms of prevention and particularly for women, and what are some of these underlying issues. And again, I think that's going to come up broader, more and more as the time goes by. And then I think in the realm of treatment, which also continued to be a highlight of how do we get treatment for people around the world, I think that we squarely said as a world community, there is no turning back on our commitment to universal access to treatment to people around the world. We're not sure how we're going to get there. We've got a lot of good examples of how we have made an impact, but we just can't turn back, and we've got to figure out a way that making sure that people have access to treatment and care and all of the aspects that wrap around that has to continue to be a world priority, and that even people who didn't think about this before are thinking about how their research and how their work impacts the ability to get treatment to the people who need it most. And I think that was just an almost a given in the discussions that we had, not an if we could, but this is a given and this is a world commitment. I think the areas where we all wish there was more hope and there wasn't are advances on things like vaccines. We continue to talk about how a safe and effective vaccine, is going to be the ultimate in making a difference in this epidemic. And we continue to have advances and new progress, but more and more less clarity about, are we talking about 10 years? Are we talking about 15 years? Are we talking about a preventive vaccine? Or are we talking about a therapeutic vaccine that once people get infected, keeps them from getting symptoms or keeps the period of asymptomatic period longer? More talk about a therapeutic vaccine than ever before. So I think the issues around that, while not discouraging, because I think there's forward movement, there's greater unclarity about how long that's going to take us. And I think gives higher priority to some of the other areas like microbicides and other preventive strategies where we can hope to have results in a shorter period of time. So I think that's an area that we need to keep watching and making sure that the world doesn't give up on, because we still believe that it's an incredibly important area, but one where it is going to be a marathon and not a sprint. And I think that the whole change in how fast the pace of science is moving forward is one that we have to accept. You know, 15 years ago, these conferences were all about breaking new scientific news. Well, that's not going to be the same in this phase of the epidemic. Increasingly, we have to recognize there are going to be incremental scientific changes, incremental new knowledge, but the breakthroughs are going to be more programmatic breakthroughs. The breakthroughs are going to be in our ability to show what it takes to make a difference with the tools that we currently have. And I think it's a difference. Particularly, we get it a lot from the science writers who all want to know, what's the breaking news? Well, I think the breaking news is that we can make a difference in this epidemic, and we've got to be very comfortable with that being our goal, that increasingly what we should be reporting are declining rates of infections at national levels, declining rates of mortality because we get access to antiretroviral therapy, and start realizing that the breakthroughs are in our ability to make a difference. Finally, I just will say that the one area that I think, you know, I think we had a great scientific meeting, lots of good discussion, a lot of good science presented, again, with the caveat that, you know, the breakthroughs are not overwhelming. A lot of good work on prevention policy, prevention programs, prevention science, and a lot of good work on the clinical side and how we're doing for new therapies, new treatment, and access to antiretroviral therapies and other issues related to care. I think where I think we need to do more work is in the area of the social sciences and behavioral sciences. And I think we're not giving it the kind of rigor and the kind of attention that it deserves, the presentations, and in policy areas. I think we're not necessarily taking them as a serious important sciences to apply to this epidemic as we are some of the, you know, quote, more hard sciences that people have relied on. And that if we are really going to look at how do you make a difference in underlying vulnerabilities, policy issues, some of the things that we always rhetorically talk about are critical for having an impact on this epidemic, if we don't study those as rigorously as we study clinical indicators, new prevention science, et cetera, I think we're not going to be able to get the answers that show that how we make a tangible difference around some of these other policy, behavioral, economic issues that we know are also important issues and important drivers for the epidemic. So I'll just stop there and look forward to comments from my colleagues.
Thanks, Helene. I wanted to comment. I love the necklace in the opening, and so I'm getting on to really important things. You looked fabulous. So, like many of those in the room, I'm actually interested in finding out how many in the room actually were in Toronto. Oh, good. Well, so you'll be able to tell me what happened, because I honestly don't know very much about what happened. I traveled in a little bit of a bubble, so I'll tell you in a few minutes about that bubble, and then hopefully you can tell me what happened in the rest of the conference. my first conference, as Jen said, was a while ago. I think Amsterdam was actually the first time I went there, and I went as a representative of ACT UP Boston. So I had the required T-shirt and black boots and the angry scowl, and I was sort of, you know, talking about what it was like to do needle exchange in the streets of Boston. And then I stopped going because I felt like it was just a jamboree, and it was very unsettling to me to see that many people coming together. And then I went back again to Durban. And this time I went as a staff person at the White House. And so there my friends from ACT UP were outside the gates with their protest signs, and I was going through in a big black Mercedes limousine. And I was on the floor of the car hiding. And my boss at the time, who shall go unnamed, Sandy, had the window down, was waving like the queen going through the crowd. And I'm like, this is the lowest point in my entire life, right? And she was loving the attention. And then I went back again later to Bangkok, I think it was, when I was working as a consultant to the Gates Foundation and Kaiser, and watching two very powerful women sort of participate. And it was, again, a kind of a different take on things. So I've not been to all the conferences, but I've seen enough of the staccato of them to understand that they have had a rhythm and it's changed over time. And I think it is important for us to talk about where they should go and perhaps what we can do to get them there. It was kind of an important time for us to look back. It was 25 years of AIDS and 20 years of the conference and 10 years since Vancouver, also 10 years since IAVI was started, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. So lots of those kind of looking back dates, and that was partly, okay, where are we now? And I think that was a reflection of the fact that this was not a conference with big scientific breakthroughs, as Helene said. There was no groundbreaking science that was going to change the course of the epidemic, such as has happened in the past. So I think we had to find out of that conference other things to look for. I do think that there was a new focus on prevention, and I'd like to talk about that in a minute. I think that there was also more involvement of sort of celebrities, and it was an interesting, since I was part of that, to understand what impact that might have had on the conference. I know that a couple of my friends commented later they thought it had become a three-ring circus. And I also recall years back when we were kind of angry that so-called celebrities weren't showing up, that this was an epidemic that was raging and they weren't paying any attention to it. And in fact, now we were not only seeing celebrities, we were seeing celebrities who did stuff in between the conferences. So they didn't stick a red ribbon on their lapel and show up 2 years and kind of say, here I am, AIDS is bad, you know. You had people like Richard Gere, who does a lot of work day in and day out in addressing India. Bill Clinton, who I think really has put a lot of effort into the work of his foundation. And I think Bill and Melinda Gates, for whom I work, I think have actually shown that it's not a passing commitment. In fact, I think they said in their opening comments that AIDS was the top priority of their foundation. And the fact that Warren Buffett has now committed significant funding to our foundation has automatically makes that his top foundation priority. That's a pretty important thing to hear. Let me tell you a little bit about the bubble that I was in, which is sort of traveling with Bill and Melinda. I think that going to the conference ahead of time, we had a couple primary goals. One of them was, I think, as Helene said, to put a new focus on HIV prevention. It was interesting to see the clip of President Clinton talking about how we couldn't talk about treatment anymore without thinking about prevention. And it was maybe just a conference or two back where the exact opposite conversation was happening. We couldn't talk about prevention without starting to think about treatment. So I think in a very short amount of time, the conversation around the global response to AIDS has really shifted quite a bit. And I think from the perspective of our foundation, what we're looking for is a little bit of balance, that we need, as was said, a combination approach to the entire epidemic and not just treatment. The second effort was obviously to put a focus on women. I think that you heard both in Bill and Melinda's comments in the opening session and later in the panels in which they were participants, a lot of comments about the importance of addressing the gender dynamics of the epidemic. I think hopefully you heard strong words from Bill and Melinda. I think we were careful to make sure that it wasn't just Melinda talking about the women's issues and Bill talking about the science, and that was a deliberate effort. And it wasn't staged an effort. I think that truly reflects where both of them are and where the commitment of our foundation is. There was also quite a bit of a conversation in their opening sessions and in their panels about microbicides and the fact that they believe that that's an area where even increased investment from our foundation and from others is absolutely crucial. I think that reflects, as Helene said, the fact that while we all recognize the importance of vaccines and are fully committed to them, we need something in the interim, and that, most importantly, has to be something that's under the control of women. And so I think for us, kind of the next prize is going to be microbicide, and that's worthy of additional investment. There were a few secondary efforts on our part. We wanted to give the Global Fund a push. I think that in the week before the conference, we announced a new contribution to the Global Fund of $500 million. And I think that there was a significant comments from both Bill and Melinda in support of the Global Fund. Again, that was deliberate. I think that we wanted to tell the world that we see this as a critical investment opportunity for donors and that hopefully other donors will as well. And so I think the having someone who's seen as sort of an outside, independent, plain-spoken arbiter on these things, which I think is the position that Bill Gates has seen largely, say that this is a worthy and good investment, hopefully will have resonance with other donors. And I actually saw a number of them in the rooms afterwards, and they said good things about how this would help them in their own work. We did want to talk about HIV prevention technologies. That's an area in which our foundation makes significant investments. We're obviously looking for results on several studies around male circumcision. That will be an important intervention to roll out. I think there's a lot of research needed still to understand how to implement that and what the repercussions might be for women, but still obviously one of the first investments that this foundation has made in a prevention technology for HIV that will actually show results. So I think that's quite an important thing for us. Things like PrEP, pre-exposure prevention prophylaxis with an antiviral. I think you heard a lot of pointed comments from Bill in particular around his frustration about some of the studies of that tenofovir product being shut down by some activists who were actually, you know, spreading what we believe to be mistruths about the drug and stirring up a lot of political dissension that wasted a whole lot of time and a lot of money for a product that actually looks quite promising. And then, you know, looking down a little bit, obviously, we did reaffirm our commitment to vaccines. So we were trying to make sure that when people heard our emphasis on microbicides, they weren't hearing a shift away from vaccines. So a few weeks before the conference, we also announced a new set of grants in the area of HIV vaccine research, totaling a little shy of $300 million. And lastly, I'd say we wanted to put a little emphasis on PEPFAR. I think that it was curious that when Bill mentioned PEPFAR in the opening session, there were boos in the audience. I think that really kind of took him by surprise. And I think you heard a lot of comments from both he and Bill Clinton later on about how we ought to be understanding the massive impact that PEPFAR has had on the global efforts on HIV and to not to deal with it in a simplistic effort. I think that when he was asked about this later on during the panel with Mr. Clinton, he said, which is something I believe as well, that for treatment, you know, PEPFAR has absolutely changed the landscape. And, you know, President Bush deserves a huge amount of credit for putting that forward and for changing the millions to billions. It was something that we were looking for quite some time. On the prevention area, it's obviously a lot more complicated, and I think that we all appreciate that. But I think that as PEPFAR goes up for reauthorization and as we struggle to get the resources that it needs, we need to be a little bit more careful around how we lambast that program that's so essential to so many lives. Final comments on the conference. I sort of, like many of you who have been to a lot of them, get tired of them, and sort of you wonder around when you see so many people and so many boos and so much going on about whether or not this is really worth all of it. And actually, they're quite expensive. And I have to remember sometimes that I've been going to these things for a long time, and I usually at that point stop to talk to somebody for whom this is the first or second conference, and you get a very, very different perspective. So I think, you know, sometimes I have to remember that my tiredness of the conferences is my tiredness of the epidemic, you know, that the conferences still serve an extremely useful purpose. Different purposes for some of us. I mean, for me, honestly, it's more an opportunity to see old friends, occasionally to miss a friend that's not there anymore. A chance to network. You know, there are lots of people from all over the world I never get a chance to see except at the conferences, so it's a great time to actually have a bunch of meetings. So it's quite convenient from that perspective. Do I go to a lot of sessions? No, don't have time. So, but for other people, that's really important. So I think that we have to stop looking at the conference as something that's somehow going to magically fit the needs of all 30,000 participants in the same way. You've got to do something about that registration line, by the way. Second, I think that there are a bunch of activists running around who have not anymore. That's right. Who have to kind of grow up a little bit. I mean, I think that there's kind of like a rambling protest that was sort of moving around all over the place, and it kind of popped up in unusual places, and we couldn't figure out what that was about. And sort of, I remember in the opening session when Peter Piot went out, and he was sort of introduced and started speaking, and then there was like a protest, and Bill was in the holding room. He's like, why are they protesting Peter Piot? And I said, well, they're not really. They're sort of, it's a protest about more funding for nurses. And he's like, well, who'd be against that? And then they showed up again at the Bill panel the next day and, you know, started protesting again. And I think Charlene was like, heard you. And then Bill's like, well, actually, we all agree with you. So it was interesting to sort of see that the protest was about something for which there really wasn't any controversy. And I think that, you know, we have to sort of come up with new ways to direct some of that energy that's more helpful. Lastly, I think that it would be nice if the U.S. Withdrew the immigration ban that has really created a problem for this conference. I think that the fact that we have to go to Canada to, you know, attend an AIDS conference is a real problem. And for those of you who don't know, the reason that the AIDS conference will not come back to the United States is because of our immigration ban on people with HIV. So I think that that's sort of an anachronism. It reflects a xenophobia and sort of a ill-considered approach to HIV that I think most people in Congress and the administration would not support. I just don't think there's been kind of an effort to overcome it. I think now's the time. It would be great to have the conference back in the United States.
Could I just add one point, and you kind of brought that up a little bit. You know, when one of the key issues and key focus of this meeting is the advocacy value. I mean, it has a huge ability to shine the light on HIV like it just doesn't happen in the intervening period of time. And so, you know, the importance of this conference as an advocacy conference to get messages out to the rest of the world who aren't at the conference is huge. And in that regard, you know, we really want to say thanks to Kaiser, as well as the whole press and media corps that was there. I forget the count we had this year, but it was more journalists than we've ever had. And it really is critically important because this is when the rest of the world also pays attention to AIDS. Clearly, just like we talked about the conference, we want this not to be the only time when the media pays attention. But it is an important advocacy platform. And in that regard, piggybacking on what Todd said, I just do think this issue of the ability to have this conference in the United States is really, really important. Because if you were there, the Canadian press had an article every single day about on front page about this conference. The U.S. press, including major national media, did a good job as well. And, you know, I was really impressed by, you know, what we saw in Washington Post and New York Times and, you know,
Boston Globe,
USA Today, and you know, L.A. Times, other, you know, national media. I know the Boston Globe was here, which is why he said it. But, you know, Bloomberg was also here. But, you know, it was well covered. But there was still a difference between how it affected Canada, how it woke up how it was able to talk to political issues within the country. So there's just something about having the conference in the country. It made a big difference, not as much difference as we wanted, but South Africa, you know, it really made a difference having it there. It made a difference having it in Spain and, you know, what it did to the European community. So we can't underestimate the value of having these conferences in this country. You know, complicated. Both Todd and I were in government when, you know, these issues were debated. But I just think it's one that we need to figure out, are there ways that we could do a carve-out or something so that this conference could come to the United States? And I think that's something that this group could think about and take on.
Thank you. On this issue of the visa ban, we did some work on that a few years ago and as part of the task force and looked at the background of that ban and the genesis of it and the political circumstances that accounted for it and argued at that time that enough had changed that a little bit of leadership in Congress and in the administration could move this forward with very low costs. And I think one of the takeaways from Toronto is the payoff for the American people and for the sustainment of U.S. leadership would be enormous if we were able to host this conference in the future in the United States. And it would also earn Congress and the administration significant credit globally and help correct another problem that I'll speak more about, which is declining legitimacy and standing in the outside world, even in a period in which U.S. leadership has been very, very strong. This odd, paradoxical, and dysfunctional reality around not getting sufficient credit for investments made. This is one measure that could be taken with direct reference to Toronto and what Toronto has done. And so I'm fully in support of what both Todd and Helene have said on this. A couple quick points of thanks. One is, Helene, I think you deserve an enormous amount of gratitude from all of us for the leadership on this particular conference. And what I mean by that is the rancor levels were down. It was a very upbeat and positive outlook. People were continually reminded of the need to think about their own responsibility in moving things forward, to avoid or refrain from the grand gestures and put a focus on the future. And I think you deserve an enormous amount of credit for that. And you also showed a remarkable remarkable grace and humility and good humor throughout this long, exhausting process. And now that you've taken on the mantle of worldwide development at CARE, we're looking forward to what that's going to mean as we carry forward, because there's a lot of discussion around how these issues connect to the development agenda. And the Gates Foundation itself has made a similar leap, and this is something that will hopefully in the coming conferences get much more attention. Great note of thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation, to Jen Cates, to Matt James, to Diane Rowland for hosting us today, for also doing this remarkable job of allowing us, giving us the instruments to try and sift through what is transpiring on a day-to-day basis, by getting John Cohen engaged in his rolling commentary, by doing a range of very focused brief interviews with key personalities. It's just a wonderful way of staying abreast of what was happening. These mega conferences are indigestible in many respects, and yet you made it very approachable, very accessible to today as well. And we're very grateful to you for that. The Canadians were extraordinary hosts. These conferences have the capacity for being, have the potential for being very uncomfortable and difficult. 26,000 people, was that the final number?
Yeah.
26,000 people scattered over these big facilities that are connected over train tracks and various other things. The Canadians were very gracious and exceedingly well organized. As far as the major implications for us, I think the fact that Bill and Melinda Gates and former President Clinton moved to center stage demonstrated that they were going to be very invested in a direct personal fashion on the substantive issues and to drive a common agenda was one of the big takeaways. It was a big shift of focus and of positioning, and it creates two very big new assets in terms of global leadership on these issues and continuity. And we should acknowledge that, that very, very important positive shift. As far as implications for the conference for U.S. policy on prevention, I think the fact that prevention was elevated and moved forward in the ways that Helene and Todd have described allows for some change potentially in our own national conversation around prevention as we head into the 2007 reauthorization debate in Congress, which has the potential for becoming more polarized versus less. And I think if we look at what happened in Toronto, some of the messages are mixed. One is there was a lot of corridor discussion around the cost, the corrosive impacts of a polarization around prevention in the ABC box, and how do we get out of that? There was a lot of acknowledgement of the risks and the costs of a divisive and sometimes fruitless set of confrontations around issues that in some ways are not as diametrically opposed as advocates present them. The other piece was you had side by side this very optimistic discussion around microbicides, PrEP, gender, circumcision, new forms of research, a widening and promising prevention agenda. And yet these two realities somehow didn't merge. The fact that prevention is changing, it needs to be elevated, the parameters need to be understood in a new and bigger way, and probably it needs much higher level of resources looking down into the future, which will be, of course, more difficult given the rising cost of bringing of sustaining mass treatment. But nonetheless, we're heading in the next 8, 9, 12 months into a period when these issues need to be managed very carefully and very sensibly, and we can take away from Toronto some of what was discussed and said and use that to advantage in informing what Congress does, but it's going to be difficult. Another big factor which Todd alluded to is the stigma attached to U.S. leadership and the ritual vilification of PEPFAR. Some of this is grounded in very real policy confrontations or controversies around the prostitution pledge, around the way that ABC is administered. These are real debates. These are real concerns. However, they are vastly overblown, and they're prone to significant distortion, and they're becoming very tired debates. And the big picture of the U.S. contribution is getting lost as a result, and only acknowledged in private corridor conversations, which I found, frankly, a bit offensive, that you could only get people to acknowledge this in private, but they would shy away from public acknowledgement of what they knew was central to sustaining the global effort into the future. It's time to bring these debates out into the open and talk more openly about them. this is a, you know, the success that the U.S. has contributed to should and cannot be buried or obscured. There's no point in that. It's bizarre and it's dysfunctional. If we do not connect the realities on the ground in the PEPFAR-focused countries with real results, if we don't connect the reality that U.S. funding contributions in this last year, in these last several years, have been absolutely essential to getting to the $8.5 billion that we're currently at. And there's a real danger that we will, if we don't revisit this issue, that the American public are going to not have a whole lot of patience with the call for dramatic expansion of U.S. commitments on global health into the future, which are going to be essential to where we go from here. So I think there needs to be a lot more strategic thinking across the board about this issue. There needs to be a lot more adult behavior across the board on this. There needs to be more leadership demonstrated. And I mean that both with respect to the administration and its posture. There's a tendency, I believe, to withdraw from the field at a very senior level in the sense that this is going to be only inviting higher levels of confrontation. At Toronto, we saw lowering levels of rancor, and I think that creates opportunity for revisiting. And bringing this conference to the United States would be a wonderful way of moving in that direction, lifting the visa ban. The critics that are on that are feeding this are also the movement itself, which is a diverse and complicated movement, was grounded in struggle. It was grounded in inequities and addressing those inequities and addressing those struggles. It's now moving towards a movement that continues to struggle in very real ways, but it's also a movement of achievement and empowerment and partnership. And it has to be able to speak to both, the continued struggle and the need to preserve and consolidate and expand those partnerships. And we haven't gotten to the ability to move to that. One other last thing I wanted to mention, which is the leadership gap from the impacted countries. The star system was overwhelmingly northern, wealthy, white, and predominantly male. And it was predominantly celebrity-driven. Now, the celebrities, as Todd pointed out, were people who were really quite substantive and serious. And that was encouraging. This was not a superficial form of celebrityhood that entered this. But there was this gap. There was an absence of key leadership figures, both from within government positions and outside government, in the heavily impacted countries. And it fed a certain amount of tension below the surface around this dichotomy, which is an artificial dichotomy. And I think that it gets back to building up the center of discussion around what are we gaining and where do we go from here requires that those leaders be there at the table in much more abundance. And part of it may have been attributable to the fact that the Canadian government itself at a senior level chose to take a powder on this conference. And that had to do with divisions or discomfort or whatever internally within the Canadian system. So you didn't have the host government leveraging leadership from these countries, and that was very unfortunate. And there's a very important lesson there. When that does not happen, you pay a big price in terms of the people that should have been at the table speaking to what they see as the essential achievements and the way forward. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks to all three of you. I actually have to say, you know, sitting here and listening, I have a lot more thoughts about the conference and feel energy about all the things you said. So hopefully that was how our audience experienced it. And I also want to say on behalf of the Kaiser Family Foundation, you know, we have done this kind of post-conference briefing before. We did it a couple of years ago with CSIS after Bangkok. We did not anticipate the overwhelming response of everyone here to want to come. We reached capacity a long time ago. And I think that just says something about the ability of this conference and Helene and all the people working on it to really make its mark. And also it too is a reflection of where we are in the epidemic, the conference itself, and the fact that there is energy whether it's people here with concern, people here with optimism, whatever, that's what we really, I think we're all experiencing that. So I want to thank you all. And in an interest of getting to your questions and comments soon, I'm just going to put one question out. I have a whole list, but I'll start with this one, because the discussion or reference to leadership came up on this panel in several comments, and there's also been recent attention in the press and otherwise to the fact that there are at least two key global health positions right now that are looking for new leaders. And I'm just curious if any of you want to comment, and I'm thinking of the Global Fund and WHO, and I'm curious if any of you want to comment about what that, you know, at this juncture, with the energy that we seem to have or want to sustain, where what opportunities does that offer, and also are there risks that we have to be aware of? That's for anyone who wants to take it on.
I think clearly having one of the big contributions that I think WHO played under the leadership of J.W. Lee and Jim Kim was the 3x5 initiative, and that became the highest priority for J.W. Lee's administration. No, we didn't get 3 million people on treatment by the goal necessarily, or won't. That was last year. So we haven't. But, you know, nonetheless, I think it made a huge difference in moving the momentum forward for universal access, and then, you know, the commitments that came after that. So, you know, having somebody who sees that as a continued priority, I think, is clear. So that one, I think, from the standpoint of political leadership, will be incredibly important to have that continue. And having the WHO get back into the AIDS arena, I think, has been critical. If people have followed the evolution of the UN response to AIDS, when UNAIDS was formed, WHO basically dropped out of the picture as a major program. And so this was the first kind of coming back into the picture and taking up the health aspects of the HIV epidemic that in some ways had perhaps gotten lost in some of it. So I think the leadership in that is critical. Likewise, I think the leadership of the Global Fund will be critical, because it is along with PEPFAR, the largest funder of treatment and also prevention programs, and has increasingly looked at how do you integrate TB and HIV, which is something that's lacking, through its guidances and through its programs, and really looking at a more multi-sectoral approach to it. So I think both of those are key positions for leadership.
The only thing I'd add is that I think that there was an opportunity missed. I think that there's a Lancet editorial, I think, about the Global Fund selection process for the replacement for Dr. Feachem, who was there along with the board chair for the Global Fund. I think it would have been nice to have, you know, that process at such a stage and a manner that it would have allowed some of the candidates to potentially engage with, you know, the folks that were at the conference. I think that would have been an appropriate thing to do. Obviously, TB and malaria, particularly malaria, is less related to the conference, but certainly having 25,000 people there who are able to sort of find out from them what their priorities are, what their approach might be to address the challenges in the front of the Global Fund would have been nice. And so I think we missed an opportunity there. I think maybe to a lesser degree the WHO, that process is a little bit more prescribed. But I think it also, you know, the emphasis on both ought to be on finding folks from the best talent, regardless of sort of where they come from or what nationality they're putting on their sleeve at the moment.
The hand, so why don't we start with your questions?
Since they're webcasting this, everyone's going to have to talk into the microphone. Otherwise, the poor people watching this on the internet are going to hear nothing.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Susie Peel. I work for Family Health International, and specifically in favor of what we call OVC. And I'd like to ask the question. I didn't hear any of you address the issue of impact mitigation, which is beyond prevention, beyond treatment and palliative care, and the vulnerability of children who have sick family members or who have been orphaned. Would any of you care to address that? Thank you.
I would just say that I think it's a good point. I don't think that we have been as have highlighted that issue as much as we should. It continues to be one of those yes and orphans. Yes, we know that we have to also look at the issues of mitigation, not only OVCs, but more broadly impact that HIV has. I think we're so focused on how do you prevent and how do you treat the kind of the upfront that we don't think about the after the fact issues or the impact issues. And I think, you know, that was somewhat what I was saying in terms of my disappointment with not holding to the same level some of these other issues that aren't as directly related to the kind of core HIV issues. What's the spill-off? What's the impact? What are the other aspects that we need to be thinking about? And I think that the OVC issue is one that in some ways is more destabilizing for societies than even the people who are themselves infected. So when we think about what it means for all the, you know, tens of millions of children who are left without families and what that means for societies, you know, we really are not thinking about that and putting the rigorous science behind that to really look at what the impact and therefore what do we need to be thinking about today as we prepare for the future. You know, I do think it then goes back to why we have to think about treating parents as orphan prevention, if you will, and really looking at even more another reason why we've got to be more aggressive about making sure we keep parents and families alive. But anyway, I agree with you. I think it's an issue we should highlight more.
Good morning. My name is Mario Guerrero, and I'm Public Affairs Director for Bienestar in Southern California. I guess I want to get clarification from you in regards to the immigration issue. I certainly know that if someone's HIV infected, that's a barrier to citizenship. But are we talking more about immigration as it relates to temporary visas to come in or the earlier part?
Yeah, I think that... As I understand it, and folks in the audience probably know more about this than I do, but the immigration restriction is actually much broader than just citizenship. It has to do with travel. So I think the only carve-out that's actually been done has been for people who are can request a waiver for attending certain events or participating in education opportunities. I think there's also a carve-out that I worked on for people seeking political asylum. So if you are an asylee and you are HIV positive in the past, there was a de facto ban, and I think that that's been eased quite a bit. But I think it's broader than just citizenship. It actually has to do a lot with more casual travel. Yeah.
There was actually a recent exception made for the UNGAS follow-up meeting, I believe, in New York. My recollection of when the start of the issue of let's not have the conference in the United States till the policy changes is also to really addressing the broad symbolic implications of the policy. And I don't know if you want to say anything about what Canada recently did in advance of the conference.
Yeah, I mean, Canada made it possible so, in order to facilitate this conference, once we recognized that they too had a statute that could have limited people coming in and made it uncomfortable for people coming in who had to show that they were on medication, could be turned back, that they actually changed that so that you could come in, you had no restrictions, if you did not have to declare whether you had whether you were taking an antiretroviral or not. And so, you know, it was the discriminatory nature of it that was part of what Canada was able to change. And I think that, you know, as both Jen and Todd said, I mean, that's part of the issue for the U.S. You can get in, but it is somewhat at the whim of whoever is processing the visa. And so it's both an absolute as well as are we, you know, a decision that was made that we wouldn't have conferences in countries that made those distinctions and made people feel discriminated against if they came into the country with HIV, and the fact that it's not a valid public health effort to discriminate people on the basis of HIV, different than tuberculosis, which you understand from a public health standpoint why you have to make sure that you don't have active TB when you come to the United States, because you can in fact infect other people. So from a public health standpoint, there doesn't seem to be a clear justification for it. So it's all of those issues, and I think we would need to work through what wouldn't be necessary to change that made sense, did not discriminate, but at the same time didn't hold the U.S. to a different standard than other countries, because clearly other countries do have requirements and restrictions on people entering their country who have HIV, mainly because of the concerns about whether or not people would come in and disproportionately need health care that would be expensive and costly. So, there are some issues there. So, I think there are some real reasons that it needs to be thought through carefully. But, the International AIDS Society has made a very strong stance that anything that is discriminatory for people entering the country, even for a travel visa, would not be a country where a conference could be held.
Concrete recent example that I was aware of on a listserv that I'm sure a lot of people here are on, someone put out the question of a woman who's coming from another country for a conference and was afraid to bring her antiretrovirals and was putting out a call for, is there some way she could ensure that she'll get them when she gets to her destination here without having to have them in her possession? So.
My name is Bill Haddad. I'm a generic drug manufacturer. I'm also head of the International Association of Generic AIDS Manufacturers. I don't want to be the skunk at the garden party because I think it was a terrific conference focused on prevention. I don't consider Gates or Clinton or Gere celebrities. They're people who've got their fingernails dirty working the field. But I must address PEPFAR. The president gave that speech in 2003 based on the generic reduction in prices, in his own words, emotionally stated, from 12,000 to 300. Since that time, until just now, generics have not been used in the program. Said very clearly in Africa by a Catholic group, marvelous woman, I can only treat one instead of four. One instead of four, and I must put up two separate systems, one for the many tablets, one for the other. So there is, I get booed overseas when I say that I believe Bush was sincere when he said it, and I still believe it to this day, but it's been several years at the higher prices. The reason, so you'll know, is that WHO had a pre-qualification program that allowed 500,000 people to get on generic AIDS drugs. The price is down to about $1 a year now by competitive bid to or $1.50. That happened. Further, just if you give me 1 second, I consider myself an activist, a business activist, and I'm goddamn proud of it. I don't mind getting booed when I mention Bush's name favorably. But that program, and I'm surprised that it became the lead news story, that program has denied treatment. Great program, great amount of money. I must tell you, we had a champagne party because we put the numbers up on the wall and we said it's the light at the end of the AIDS tunnel. $200 a year, take off $5 billion for other programs, $10 billion, $2 billion a year, along with the Global Fund. Terrific. Terrific. Now, let me say one other thing. I'm back where I was before.
So, just so we can get to
it. Okay, just let me get it in, please, and I will. I'm back where, and I wish you would address this, I'm back where we were before. We were asked by everybody in sight to do second-line treatment. Second-line treatment at 1/15th of the price is still 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times more than what is now charged for the first-line treatment. So prevention is important, work is important, But every day I find barriers everywhere, barriers to providing medicines. I would wish people would say, like Clinton did in Barcelona, we have the essential medicines to take a certain death sentence and turn it into a chronic illness, and we're not using them. That was yesterday on triples, and it's today on second-line treatment.
I think we got your point. I think I don't think anyone here has said that PEPFAR ought to be viewed, you know, simply, that it's a complicated program. It addresses a number of different needs. Sometimes it does things well. Sometimes it does things less well. Sometimes it improves over time. In other areas, it's been kind of stuck in areas where there are problems. I think the comment from most of us was that we have to be careful about providing an approach that's equally nuanced, that we can't just sort of describe PEPFAR as a disaster because there are aspects of it that need improvement. I think that we have to understand that we need to get support for this program that goes beyond just the current president, because he will only be in office for so long. Then we need to build support within Congress for this program if we expect the amount of funding to increase. And if we just simply bash the program because there are parts of it that we don't like, I think that that kind of support will be much more difficult to get. The bottom line is that a lot of people have gone out on a limb to support this program, both the administration and in Congress, and support from the general American public is not that deep. And so I don't think that they're going to pay a huge price if they just kind of stagnated funding to these programs. So I think if we all want to see the kinds of increases that we know are needed, we have to be a little bit more careful in our approach. So I
just add, my sense is that the FDA fast track on first-line therapy is beginning to function with some effect, and that was something that President Clinton emphasized in his comments and others emphasized, and that the uncertainty is really the question of the greater uncertainty right now is what to do with your other point, Mr. Haddad, around second-line therapy and true costs and how do you begin to bring those forward. I mean, that's my lay takeaway from being at Toronto and listening to people talk about this. I was expecting much more controversy around generic drugs. I walked away in my notebook saying the FDA fast track has eliminated this issue as a first line therapy as a matter of controversy, that it was not something that was on the table as a serious divisive issue. And when you looked back just 2 years or 4 years, was a hugely potentially divisive issue, and that you could say that, okay, it took longer for this to kick in and to begin to function and show results, but that certainly at Toronto there was not a lot of steam around that issue.
Hi, my name is John Donnelly with the Boston Globe. I appreciate the plug, Todd. Thanks. Yeah. I have two questions. They're related. There was another Lancet editorial recently that actually offered a critique of the Toronto AIDS conference. There were 10 suggestions in that. One of the suggestions was that the conference should be much more organized around country programs, looking specifically at what national programs are doing in order to get a better idea of what was working and what wasn't in those countries. The second question, so I'd like your response to that, if that would work in some ways. The second question seems to me that interests me a lot is about prevention and how to go forward with prevention, how to coordinate many different viewpoints in both the global leadership but also in the national level in many, many countries, especially in Africa. Would it be a good idea for a couple of African countries themselves to hold conferences about the best ways to go ahead and prevention in their country? Would it be a good idea to engage Congress now to talk about the 33% payment for abstinence programs? Is there a way that you can move the conference discussion ahead on prevention on many levels so there can be at least a couple of examples that people can see what works?
I think we're all going to probably want to jump in this, so I think I'll be quick. One, I actually think that I'd combine the two questions. I think they're related quite closely. I think that we have to find a way to sort of draw some of the conversation around international policy, international issues, and help translate that to a much more local level. Much the same as the science. I think that's good for people to come and hear about the science, but often their struggle is to figure out how to take that home and actually put it to work, implement it within their strategies. And I think there's a lot more of the translation of the international to the local that needs to happen and the conversation back from locals about what's working, what's not working. So I think that there's a lot of effort in that area that needs to take place. I also think that the International Aid Society needs to do more around supporting the regional conferences that happen in the off year from the international conference to become much more of a cycle, so that those regional conferences become much more connected to the international conference, and there therefore is much more of an opportunity to localize a lot of the conversation and then bring those different voices to the international stage and create a little bit more of a cycle of helpful information. So I think the bottom line is that the conversations at the international level are extremely helpful, but figuring out how to take that into action at the local level and then communicate back when that does or does not work is a more essential part that I think we've given energy to.
Yeah, just on your first point, that the conferences obviously can't be all things to all people, and so there are some people who want to hear the latest scientific information, so we still need the science part. That doesn't necessarily the science and also kind of what's happening at the international level, that doesn't lend itself to country-level discussions, but I think we can include those. So I think it's still – I don't think it will be a conference that will be only organized around what's the national response in different countries, but I think that element could be brought out more. So, you know, again, a conference of 20,000-plus people really does need to meet the broad needs, and some of those are not necessarily just country level. On the other, in an hour, I'm going to go to a hearing that's focused on the very issue that you're talking about. Congressman Shays has a hearing this afternoon, having gone to Uganda and Tanzania and realizing that there are issues in terms of how things actually get implemented at the country level when it comes to a more integrated approach to prevention. You know, he's asking those kind of questions. Is the 33% for abstinence until marriage the best way to make sure that that's incorporated into a comprehensive strategy or not? So those are the kinds of questions I think people are starting to ask after several years of implementing the program. Could we do it better? It's doing a lot, but are there ways of strengthening it? Are there ways of making it more easier at the country level to actually do a more comprehensive approach? And so I think there are going to increasingly be opportunities to address those kinds of issues.
If we could figure out an effective way to connect the leadership out of the key African countries on the question of prevention and what's working with those key figures in Congress who are going to be at the table on the reauthorization, that would be a huge achievement. It's also going to be very, very difficult because there is a cycling through town of lots of people that have lots of things to say. The biggest problem is getting them connected effectively to the correct people at the right time. And we need a lot more thinking about that. But as we head into the reauthorization debate, having those voices present at the right moment, talking to the right people here in Washington is going to be critical to having the right outcome.
Hi, I'm Jane Ransom, and I'm with the International Women's Media Foundation. And I just wanted to probe a little bit about the entering the fray of gender inequality and what that means. It's a call that was put out there. It's a wonderful call. The most specific example that keeps being brought up as a strategy that would fall under that is the microbicides. I don't want to discount that at all, but I want to know more about what is in the minds of the leaders that put out this call in terms of what kind of concrete strategies, in addition to that or unfolding around that, do they have in mind or might we see unfolding?
two comments. One is I think that you're right to point to sort of the narrowness of some of the interventions for addressing an issue that's extremely broad and deep. So I think that I certainly thought we were trying to be careful about not overemphasizing, you know, technologies like microbicides as the answer to the, you know, to the massive impact that HIV has on women and also the and girls, and also in reverse the impact that their reduced economic and social and political and legal status has on fueling the epidemic. So I don't think that we're simplistic enough to think that the technology is going to solve those problems. I think it's important to provide more tools that women can control that would actually give them more choices in protecting themselves for HIV. That certainly is an aspect that we are trying to address. As for addressing the entire dimension of it, I think that we do in some ways and not in others. I think, as Helene said, we're actually now our foundation is looking at broadening into a whole other arena of global development. In the past, we have simply stuck within global health. And I think that we're now branching out into new areas, and we need to figure out what that means and actually how to interconnect them. I think that will be a real challenge for us, to figure out how our work in education in the United States, for example, might translate into, you know, education for girls as a strategy to keep them from becoming HIV infected in the first place. So I think that yes, your point's right. I think we all need to learn that. The last thing, the second point I was going to say is I think that we, rather than just kind of keep saying there's a big gender disparity, we need to translate that into actionable strategies. We need to translate that for policymakers into what you want them to do really to have an impact there. So I think there's broad attention to the fact that HIV and women and girls is an important issue. I think there's less clarity around what actually to do if you buy that.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think that's, again, what I was saying. I think that the I hope at the next conference more discussion about tangible ways of taking this on will be discussed. Our organization, CARE, for instance, does a lot of work in that arena, where linking microfinance programs to women's vulnerability for HIV and a range of things is something, you know, we do more, looking at food security and how do you strengthen food security within the home, and looking at, you know, how that influences people's vulnerability. So I think the whole area of what are the some of the drivers are the kinds of things that you can concretely link and look at, you know, if you give girls education and link that to livelihood options, are they or are they not at able to be more empowered and negotiate sex. But we've got to look at that more. You know, we know the theory is there, and we're doing, CARE and other development organizations are doing that kind of work. The next step is to really evaluate what's the impact not only on women's lives, but on vulnerability to HIV, and really more concretely give people ways in which that could be done. But those are the kinds of programs that you know, we and others are working on. You know, I think the other part of it that we keep not giving the focus that I think needs to be given is men. You know, if we talk about the fact that women are at greater risk because their male partners are unfaithful, well, why aren't we doing more to look at changing norms within male behavior? And we can't keep saying that women's empowerment is always putting greater burden on women and not also looking at the other side of the equation and being equally committed to making sure that we start shifting norms, getting males to talk about behavior differently. And their programs, you know, again, some of the programs that we've worked on at CARE show that if you really have some of the same kind of self-help groups for men as we do for women, you can start changing men's ideas about what they think is the appropriate way, because they're socialized into thinking this is the way you're supposed to do it. This is the way this is the way we look at women. You can change that just as you can change women's ideas about their own power within society. So we've got to do more on that side of the equation.
I think we're only going to have time for about one more question after this.
May I just add one quick comment? I mean, I think there are many more answers out there programmatically on how you carry forward the gender agenda than we've acknowledged. I think Helene has pointed out, you know, innovative operational folks like CARE are finding way forward. Janet Fleischman's work on those that are looking at reproductive health and how to integrate that programmatically to strengthen HIV/AIDS programs also shows that innovative folks on the ground are not being idle, they're not being passive, they're pushing the margins forward.
But we could use more money.
I think there is, yeah. And the areas where critical interventions are needed have also been laid out. Legal protections, food security, reproductive health, education. I think it's pretty, we're much farther along than we were a year or two ago.
I actually think it's a real challenge, though, particularly in the U.S. policy context, to translate that into practical examples. The way the funding is categorized and how it works, understanding what an HIV intervention is in the policy context for purposes of program funding and programmatic decisions is hard. It's hard to make those concrete examples translate. So I think that's going to be a big challenge for everyone here in the next couple years to really take that next step. As I said, we have time for, I think, one, maybe two other questions.
Good morning. Marcia Martin, Administration of HIV Policy and Programs here in Washington, D.C. And first, we would like to offer to host the 2010 International HIV Conference here in the District of Columbia. We happen to be the convenient home of the nation's government, and we think it would be a wonderful venue for the conference to be held here. And I know everybody here now is up to date on what we need to do to get it to happen. We got 4 years. We can work on it just like Mexico took their 4 years to work on it. But really, directly related to something that you said, Stephen, about the need to move the hallway conversations into the public discussion. I'm wondering if Kaiser and CSIS would be interested in hosting such a series of discussions to talk about the stigma attached to U.S. policy and the need to recommit and to take these conversations that you, to quote, say, have become bizarre and dysfunctional and bring them public so we can get to what's good about what we're doing and then build on what's good about what we're doing and sort of move the context to how we can expand the resources and our commitment. And then finally in Toronto, I saw that there was a big discussion going on about testing, which none of you guys talked about. And we have a testing campaign going on here in the District of Columbia to get everybody who lives here to know their HIV status as a regular part of healthcare. And there seemed to be quite a bit of controversy flying in Toronto about what we need to be doing around testing. So I'm wanting to know if you could comment on that as well.
Just say, one, you don't have 4 years, you only have two because the decisions are made a couple years in advance, so get on it. the testing thing did come up a lot, and it was an interesting debate because, you know, more countries, and this is primarily in the global arena, there are more countries that are starting to consider routine HIV testing, like Botswana did. And I think there's a lot of concern about routine with an opt-out, which allows you to go in and say, no, I don't want to be tested, but the default is that you will be tested in routine healthcare settings, is potentially coercive and potentially a slippery slope to mandatory testing. My own feeling is that we need to make sure that we're working closely with the countries themselves and not taking our own lens into these discussions, because when you're talking about a country like a Botswana that I have had a lot of experience with, where, you know, 35 to 45% in some situations of people are HIV infected, you know, that's a very different equation than even the District of Columbia and places in the United States where we still have a less than 1% national HIV prevalence. And so, you know, when you have treatment available, when you have protection, legal protections in place, if you would do this for another prevalent disease, where is the logic around why it's a bad thing necessarily to give people the option not to have it if they don't want to? But, you know, it just, I think the bottom line is, it is important that we be working with people within the countries. And if the countries feel that this makes sense for their setting, we shouldn't be coming in from outside and saying, you know, you all just don't understand. You should be saying that your people should be, you know, should have other options. So I think that's the balance, is that it really ought to be country specific. It ought to look at all the circumstances. And we ought to have some international guidelines, which we do, around what's coercive and what's not coercive. But it, you know, it's an interesting, it became a very, very interesting side debate that we didn't anticipate.
Of the U.S. as part of the global community for those interested in this discussion in early October with Marsha Martin and someone from CDC and some others, we're going to be convening a discussion here on the new U.S. domestic recommendations around HIV testing in healthcare settings, which will get at these very, very issues. That's early October.
I was going to add, I agree with what Helene said around the issue of sort of routinizing HIV testing and sort of the preconditions that kind of need to be in place for that to make sense. I think those are absolutely critical. The other conversation that I heard in a number of places was around voluntary counseling and testing and the V and the C part of that, and whether or not they should be reduced or removed in favor of getting people tested. And I worry that in some ways that sort of that's part of a swing a little bit more towards emphasizing testing as a way to identify people who are positive to get them into treatment, rather than thinking about HIV testing as an opportunity to engage people in a healthcare system that supports both prevention and testing. And so whether or not people come in and get tested for HIV and they're determined positive or negative, there is a great opportunity there to engage someone, you know, that ought to be taken advantage of. And if you jettison the counseling part of that and the voluntariness part of that, I think that you lose a lot that's valuable. I don't think that's to say that the counseling in particular has been done particularly well. I think most people would argue that it's not been done well, but I don't think the answer is to jettison. I think the answer is to figure out how to do it right.
And just, sorry, one last comment on it. I think that what the testing debate kind of reflected was, I think, another underlying current that started surfacing about whether or not AIDS should continue to be an exceptional disease or not. And in that, you know, and I think the testing debate really, a lot of that centered around the issues of, you know, normalizing HIV. If this was, in high prevalence areas, should this be considered, you know, a routine medical condition that you get tested for because of high prevalence, just like you would other diseases? Or should there be some exceptional circumstances around it? And, you know, Peter Piot's opening comments had a lot about the importance of maintaining the exceptionality of HIV. But I think there's a strong feeling, particularly in the Boer biomedical community, that we may have exceptionalized HIV as a disease for too long. And is there an argument for saying that from a broad perspective, it is an exceptional situation, but in terms of how we handle some of the more medical aspects of it, it ought to be normalized? And so I think that debate will continue about what is the right degree of exceptionality for HIV that in many ways is a human condition like no other in our generation, but at the same time, are we impeding our ability to handle this by making some things exceptional that ought to be more, quote, normalized? And are there benefits to that from the standpoint of reducing stigma? So I think that's kind of what was reflected in a lot of those discussions, and I think that will continue to be a very interesting discussion as we think about the appropriate way to put HIV in its broader context.
Marsha, first of all, thank you for, as a D.C. resident, thank you for what you've done in this last phase, both with respect to testing but also in taking a whole look at how the district goes about its programs. You've made an enormous contribution. On the question you pose about Kaiser and CSIS hosting a series of discussions around this, I can't speak for my colleague on the Kaiser side, but certainly we are committed, and I believe we'll be able to do something jointly. And this is part of our thinking around looking ahead into this next phase, is that I think we can be helpful along with others in trying to promote that debate. And we have a wonderful partnership here with Kaiser. On the testing issue, my sense was that there was an emerging consensus around a way forward here as the debate kind of moves along. And I remember that when Steve Lewis's closing speech, in which he went through, I don't know, 15 different items that were on his mind. And a lot of them were pretty negative and pretty kind of, warning shots around this has to get more attention, this has to get more attention. Some very harsh closing comments about South Africa. There was one big positive piece, which is around the progress made in thinking about testing. And I think he got it kind of right on that piece. And I came away with a much more positive sense that all of this churning in the last couple of years, with lots of country-based experience driving the debate, was being quite helpful.
I guess I want to add, I think that when you talk to different people, you get different responses to this. I think that a lot of people living with HIV who are in circumstances that are quite difficult see the issue in very different light than maybe medical professionals do or people from developed countries. And I think that we, you know, maybe to pick up on John Donnelly's earlier question or comment, I think that you know, all of this is localized. It's quite different in Nepal than it is, you know, in Cameroon. So I think that we have to understand that there are no simple answers to any of this, that there is no response or policy around testing that's going to work in some places. It may make sense in Botswana. It's less than 2 million people. They have universal access to treatment. They have political protections and commitment, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it doesn't work in Nepal where, you know, you lose your job, lose your life, lose your family when you're found out to be HIV positive.
Or it doesn't necessarily work if you're a woman whose husband then kicks you
right
out of the house.
So, I think the bottom line in a lot of this is that efforts to simplify things don't work in this epidemic, and that's a conversation we've had around prevention. ABC, you know, aspects of that work. It's too simplistic our approach to deal with the multiplexity of the problem. And so I think that, you know, as we've done with treatment, where you need an army of different kinds of medications at the same time to be effective, I think we need to deal with the epidemic in a little bit more of a textured approach and sort of combination prevention, combination of treatment, combination approach to the entire arrangement, including some of the issues around gender, for example.
We are unfortunately out of time, and I know Helene needs to go to the Hill to talk about the importance of prevention. And unless, Helene, you wanted to say a closing comment, I would hope that the audience would join me in thanking our panelists for a great conversation. Thank you. Thank you.